1 Samuel 17 and verse 1. Now the Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered at Succoth, which belongs to Judah. They encamped between Succoth and Azekah in Ephes Damin. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in a battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And a champion went out from the camp of the Philistines, named Goliath, from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail, and the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. And he had bronze armor on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. Now the staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels. And a shield bearer went before him. Then he stood and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? Are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the armies of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together." Then Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine. They were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of the Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse, who had 8 sons. And the man was old, advanced in years in the days of Saul. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. The names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, the firstborn, next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. David was the youngest, and the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. And the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. Then Jesse said to his son David, "Take now for your brothers an ephah of this dried grain and these 10 loaves, and run to your brothers at the camp, and carry these 10 cheeses to the captain of their 1,000, and see how your brothers fare, and bring back news of them." Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with a keeper, and took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the camp as the army was going out to the fight and shouting for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. And David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper, ran to the army, and came and greeted his brothers. Then as he talked with them, there was the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines, and he spoke according to the same words. So David heard them. And all the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were dreadfully afraid. So the men of Israel said, "Have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And it shall be that the man who kills him, the king will enrich him with great riches, will give him his daughter, and give his father's house exemption from tax in Israel." Then David spoke to the men who stood by him, saying, "What shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine, that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in this manner, saying, "So shall it be done for the man who kills him." Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was aroused against David. And he said, "Why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart. You have come down to see the battle." And David said, "What have I done now? Is there not a cause? Then he turned from him toward another and said the same thing, and these people answered him as the first ones did. Now when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for him. Then David said to Saul, Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine. And Saul said to David, You are not able to go against the Philistine to fight with him, for you're a youth, and he's a man of war from his youth. But David said to Saul, Your servant used to keep his father's sheep. And when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck it and killed it. Your servant has killed both lion and bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, seeing he has defied the armies of the living God. Moreover, David said, The Lord, who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, Go, and the Lord be with you. Amen. The slaying of Goliath by David is one of the best known Bible stories. It's one of those few scripture accounts which unchurched people in 2018 are still reasonably familiar, and I dare say you've heard it preached on a number of times. Nevertheless, let's look at it from the beginning of chapter 17. It begins by saying, The Philistines gathered their armies together to battle and were gathered at Succoth, which belongs to Judah. Now, in the previous chapter, we've had the anointing of David as king over Israel, and it's quite a domestic scene. Samuel goes to visit David among his family, and he is anointed, and that all seems to be very well and good, but there is trouble brewing, and maybe Samuel was already aware of it. I dare say David was not, but the Philistines are gathering together. Now, the Philistines are sometimes called the sea peoples. They invaded the Middle East, possibly from the areas around Greece. They needed land, they needed agriculture, and so they invaded some generations back. And what we have here in that first verse is two characteristics of the enemy. The first thing is that the enemy is gathering. So the enemy was already there, but it's concentrating, it's gathering together, because if you want to attack, you've got to form an army. And so they've called the labourers on their farms, they've called the townsmen, get together, bring your weapons, it's time for battle. And the other characteristic is that the enemy occupies territory that doesn't belong to him. I said before in the short homily I gave on Palm Sunday, that Jesus came to earth to expel not the Romans, who arguably should not have been in the Holy Land, but from sin, which should not be found in the human heart. We were made to have fellowship with God in that garden. We were made to have communion with God. He would know us, and we would know him. But sin entered and spoiled it and erected barriers and walls and fences between the created and the creator. And Satan, who has no business on this planet, assumed an authority which was not his. The enemy has regathered, and it's on the territory of Judah. They encamped between Succoth and Azekah in Ephes Damim, and Saul and the men of Israel were gathered together, and they camped in the valley of Elah and drew up in battle array against the Philistines. The Philistines stood on a mountain on one side, and Israel stood on a mountain on the other side with a valley between them. So far, so good. When you're facing an opposing army, it's always good for you to be on a hill
Here it says mountain in the New King James Version. Because if they attack you first, they've got to go to the trouble of clambering up a hill with all their arms and armour. And by the time they get to you, they're quite tired, and therefore they're less likely to attack you with the vigour which they would like to. They're both arrayed and they're both ready to fight. Israel has its king with them. The Philistines don't really have a king. They were more like a federation. There were five or so cities, each having their own leader, which is why it talks about the king of Israel. Now, Saul, we have already discovered, is not a great king. He's certainly not a man after God's own heart, but no one has ever doubted his valour and his courage. And so Saul is with them. He's a good king to have with you at that point. Unfortunately, though, the enemy has a secret weapon. And verse 4 tells us all about him. And a champion went forth from the camp of the Philistines. A champion, a particular soldier who was known for his fighting prowess, would sometimes go to an opposing army and say, "Listen, let's make this far easier. You choose your best soldier, and he will fight our best soldier, and we'll cut out all the kind of middlemen. And that will determine the outcome of the battle. Obviously, you'll become our slaves if we win, and vice versa. But the alternative is that most of you will die, and most of us will die." There is kind of a logic to it. And of course, people in the ancient world would almost certainly have thought that whichever champion had the strongest gods, he would prevail. There's a logic to that as well. Indeed, it is the case. We're told he was named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. I must admit, I don't tend to measure people's height in cubits and spans. I was never taught imperial. I wasn't old enough. And yet neither can I look at someone and say, "Oh, he's 1.3 metres. It just doesn't work, does it? Imperial works for height. So almost certainly something like 9'2" or something like that. Is it believable that somebody could be so tall? Well, I did a little bit of digging. Apparently there was once a Mongolian herdsman called Bao Zhishun, who was 7'9", and coming from Liverpool, Hale in Liverpool in 1600, one John Middleton apparently was measured as being 9 feet high, and various people at the time vouched for it. So I think it's more than perfectly possible. Although ironically, people who are exceptionally tall often have a weak heart. You can make all sorts of points out of that when it comes to talking about Goliath. Nevertheless, he's very tall. He's very tall, but he's not the beanpole. He's also rather wide. He's rather strong. He's rather angry. He's not the kind of gentleman you'd like to meet. You wouldn't want to meet him in a dark alley. You wouldn't want to meet him on the battlefield. In fact, I think it's fair to say you wouldn't want to meet him. And this is why, verse 5, he had a bronze helmet on his head. He has with him, he's wearing he's armed with a coat of mail. So metal links put together. So if you try and attack him with a sword, the metal links will take the blow. He'll probably bruise him, but it won't cut him. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. Again, what does that mean? 57 kilograms if you're young, or 126 pounds if you are old. So he's actually incredibly well protected. So he's a strong man, so when he comes to attack you, he's pretty powerful, but should you ever even get close to him, would you even get through his armour? As champions go, he's pretty good. The writer goes on. He had bronze armour on his legs and a bronze javelin between his shoulders. In other words, he's carrying it on his back. You can see it poking out from behind him. The staff of his spear was like a weaver's beam. In other words, it's rather thick. And his iron spearhead weighed 600 shekels, and a shield bearer went before him. Now, there's a detail there which would almost certainly pass us by. And it's the metal from which the spearhead is made. It's made of iron. So what? Well, this story is set in the Bronze Age. We haven't yet got to the Iron Age. Well, clearly some people have, a little bit. And iron is a stronger metal. And if your blades are made of iron, but your opponents are made of bronze, it might just give you that edge. This man has a very advanced weapon. Now, if you take all those factors together, the advanced weapon, the wonderful armor, the size of the man, his natural aggression, everything is going in his favor. No wonder the Philistines want there to be a champion versus champion battle. They're almost certainly going to win. Then he stood up and cried out to the armies of Israel and said to them, "Why have you come out to line up for battle?" Well, that's quite a strange question on the face of it. Because if you invade another country, that is generally what happens. He's not asking them a question. He's not trying to find out information. He's making a point. And the point is this. We have an army. You have an army. So why are you stood there looking at us? Come on. Come and fight. Take us on. But they don't seem to want to. Verse 8. "Am I not a Philistine, and you the servants of Saul?" Now he knows that the Hebrews consider themselves to be the chosen people of God. "I'm just a Philistine. You're the servants of a great king. Come on, choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants." Again, it's a fairly good deal. But coming from Goliath, it's not such a good deal. Not from the Israelite perspective. He then goes on to insult them. "I defy the armies of Israel. Again, give me a man that we may fight together." And we're told that the Israelite reaction was one of dismay and fear. There's an enemy on their territory. It's a large army, and with it, there's a large champion. And from a human point of view, they know they're going to lose. Now, of course, we know the outcome. We know, you knew what happened in the end of the story, even though I never read it. But at this stage, they don't yet know what's going to happen. And I think it demonstrates here, and I know it's easy for me to say it in this comfortable pulpit, but where was their trust in God? Did they not think that the God who gave them that land would not also let them keep it? That the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, the God of Moses, the God of Gideon, how many more should I mention? Would that God not protect them on this day as he's protected them before? There's a point here for us. As a Christian, you should never be afraid of anything. Because the God who defended you and protected you and guided you and cared for you in the past, he changeth not. Whether it's the Philistines or the Midianites or whoever. Jesus said, "I will be with you even unto the end of the age." And we live in a country which is increasingly secular. I don't mind that per se. I believe in religious freedom. But the secularism of our country, I think, is turning to aggression towards anyone who doesn't toe the line. who believes in things which are now considered old-fashioned. And I think there is a genuine fear. I say again, the God of 1 Samuel chapter 17 is our God. And although the army of Israel look at the enemy and say, how on earth can we prevail? How on earth can we win? The fact is they do. Because God has already determined the means. In verse 12, we've got a scene elsewhere. Now David was the son of that Ephrathite of Bethlehem, Judah, whose name was Jesse. Hold on, we know that. We only had it in chapter 16. The writer feels the need to remind us of who David is. And remember, at this point in Israelite history, he is not well known. He is the youngest son of a provincial gentleman. Most of the people in the army have never heard of him. They may not even have heard of Jesse. He had 8 sons. We know that as well. The man was old, advanced in years, in the days of Saul. The 3 older sons of Jesse had gone to follow Saul to the battle. The names of his 3 sons who went to the battle were Eliab, Abinadab, and Shammah. Now again, we remember those from the previous chapter. And I imagine that these are impressive young men. Because when Samuel looked at them in the previous chapter, certainly the first one, he thought, oh, it must be him. He must be the next king of Israel. He looks like a warrior. He's intelligent. He's well-read. He'd be able to lead the troops into battle. But the Lord said, I've rejected him. Because the Lord was considering the heart. And like Saul, these 3 young men, I have no doubt they were courageous. Not so courageous to take on Goliath, mind, but courageous. And they looked the part. They probably resembled future kings. But like the rest of the army, their outsides were impressive, but their insides were lacking spiritually. In verse 14, we have yet more repetition. David was the youngest. Why is it repeating itself? Because the writer is really emphasizing that God is using the weak to rescue the strong. And that's what God does in the Bible. He chooses the things which are nothing, the things which are not, the foolish to confound the wise and the strong. The 3 oldest went off to follow Saul. They went to join the army because they're the tough guys. But in verse 15 we're told, David occasionally went and returned from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. You'll recall that Saul has given David a job at court, that when Saul is tormented by the spirit, David will play to him and soothe him. And I guess perhaps it's a promotion for being a shepherd. But every now and again, he's sent back to do his farm work. Let's look at this from David's point of view for a moment. Hasn't Samuel promised that he's going to be a king? And yet here he is being sent back to the farm to look after sheep. He may have been given a place at court with fancy new clothes, but every now and again he's still a farmhand. And notice at the moment Saul doesn't require him. Saul requires men, tough men, not lads with harps. And maybe David is thinking, this is beneath me, I shouldn't be here. But there's something about David, there's a humility about his spirit. That when he's sent home to look after the sheep, he just does it. And I cannot help but wonder that when we're faithful to God in the small things, then will he entrust to us the big things? When you're willing to look after a few sheep and guard them from a lion, then will God make you the champion of Israel. But had I think David said, looking after sheep is beneath me, it's servant's work. I should be a warrior like the others. Let me tell you, he too would have appeared before Samuel, and he too would have been rejected by God. God is not looking this morning for a tough guy. He's not looking for people who are externally strong. He's looking for people who are humble in spirit and willing to serve. You show me a Christian who's humble. You show me a Christian who's willing. And I'll show you the leader of the next revival in this country. In verse 16, the scene goes back to the battle. And the Philistine drew near and presented himself 40 days, morning and evening. That verse does stick out. Because in verse 17, we go back to the farm in Bethlehem. It's like when you're watching a film or a TV show, you'll go from scene to scene because they're happening at the same time, and the writer quite skillfully manages it here in the chapter. So why in verse 16 does it stand out? The writer is reminding us that even while David sits, perhaps feeling a little frustrated among those sheep, the threat of evil grows and is ever present. 40 days is a long time to wait. Israel is being ridiculed. But God is working. In verse 17, Jesse the father sends David on an errand to take some food to his brothers and some cheeses to the officers, and basically to find out how his brothers are doing. It's a fairly common errand. It doesn't require a great deal of skill. Again, David might still be thinking, you know, I'm a bit of a farmhand and now I'm being used as an errand boy. I thought Samuel said I was going to be a king. Again, when we're obedient in the little things, then will God give us the bigger things? I would also suggest that it's in completing a menial task that we often find other more noble doorways opening before us. What if David had refused? What if David had said, Father, send a servant. I've had enough of being ordered around. I'm a king. I should be ordering you around. I'm going to stay inside. Or what if it said, actually, no, I'm going to stay with my sheep. But he didn't. I wouldn't like to think what would have happened if he did. He didn't. His father sends him to the sheep. He goes. His father sends him to carry some cheeses and grain. He goes. The scene then reverts back to the battleground. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. Well, that's ironic. That's the very thing they're not doing. They're not fighting with the Philistines. They're staring at them. They're looking at them. They're fearing them. In fact, they're not even technically in the valley. They're staying in their defensive position on the mountainside, on the hill. Perhaps even the word men in verse 19 is being ironic. Goliath asks for one man, and not one can be provided. So David rose early in the morning, left the sheep with a keeper. Again, why wasn't that keeper, that paid hand, why wasn't he doing the shepherding work to start with? We don't know. All I can keep on saying is that by doing menial servant's work, a certain humility was found in David. And that's why I think he was Israel's greatest king. Can we not see here a picture of actually Israel's greatest greatest king, Christ himself, great David's greater son, who considered equality with God not something to be grasped, but humbled himself and took upon the nature of a slave. He took the things and went as Jesse had commanded him. An obedient lad, and not beneath manual work. He came to the camp as the army was going out to fight and shouting for the battle. For Israel and the Philistines had drawn up in battle array, army against army. Again, it's a charade. It's a rigmarole, it's a piece of theatre. They draw up, we draw up. We look at them, they look at us. Their champion comes forth and says, "Give me a man," and we run away. And we do that day after day after day after day. And the Philistines think it's great. Remember, the Israelites aren't on Philistine territory. The Philistines are on Israelite territory. And they're robbing the nearby farms of the food while they're there, costing them nothing. Verse 22, David discharges his job. He runs to the army and greets his brothers. And they talk. And while that's going on, Goliath appears. Goliath by name, coming up from the armies of the Philistines. I can imagine as the ranks of the Philistine army parts and this huge giant walks through with his armor bearer, with his bronze weapons and his shield and his chainmail. He must have looked impressive. And he says his usual words. And there's jeers from the Philistine camp. And we're told that David hears them. He's never heard them before. But he hears them now. Have you seen this man who has come up? He has come up to defy Israel. 41 times now, he's defied the armies of Israel. And Israel has responded the same way. They're tolerating it. They're putting up with it. Acquiescing. But one has come among them now who's not prepared to put up with it. If he's defying the armies of Israel on Israelite territory, we need to do something about it. And evidently Saul has tried to offer greater inducements to persuade one of his men to go and kill Goliath. The king will enrich him with great riches. He will give him his daughter, don't know what she thinks about that, and his father's house exemption from tax in Israel. There's plenty in our country who don't like paying tax. That's quite an incentive. Unfortunately, it does mean fighting a kind of bionic man. And despite these incentives, nobody comes forward. And then David asks, what will be done for the man who kills the Philistine? Evidently, David didn't hear the answer. Maybe he was too busy assessing Goliath. Maybe he was in awe of this giant. But David recognizes, when he talks about in verse 26, the reproach from Israel. He recognizes not just the physical danger, but the shame of being insulted in his own land by a foreigner. Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Again, David isn't actually asking for his name. He's called Goliath. Oh, right, okay, no problem. He's saying he shouldn't be here. He shouldn't be doing it. Notice, though, that David is not impressed by the offer of wealth. He wishes to serve his God and remove disgrace from Israel. He sees Goliath for what he is. Is he perhaps also commenting on Goliath's own manhood in that verse? Perhaps he's suggesting that although he's externally hard, internally he is uncouth and unclean. He also sees Israel for what Israel really is. although outwardly soft, in fact, Israel can call upon a God who has huge resources at his disposal. Of course, the Philistines have gods as well. We meet some of them later on in the Bible. Dagon, for example. Unfortunately for the Philistines, Dagon didn't exist, which is something of a disadvantage. But although the Philistines outwardly are tough, and we feel and look weak, let me tell you, friends, if God is for you, who can be against you? In verse 28, we're told that Eliab, his oldest brother, his anger was aroused against David and asks, "Why did you come down here?" Maybe he thinks that David is trying to make them feel worse about the situation. You know, these are men who, although they don't want to fight Goliath, they are trained in warfare. And then this young lad comes along, who's, you know, a shepherd by day and a harpist by night, and appears to start suggesting to them how they ought to behave and what they ought to do. And in fact, if anything, what he's really doing is simply telling them the problem. I remember once my kitchen flooded, and a neighbour came in and said, "Oh, I think your kitchen's flooded." And I said, "Thank you." And I showed him the door before I showed him something else. David simply seems to be coming and saying, "Look, there's a bigger champion there who's making fun of you. Thank you." He says, "With whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness?" Now, Eliab denigrates David on three different levels. He says, number one, "Go back to your farm work, farm boy. Leave the fighting to us." He even indicates that David's flock is not especially significant. Those few sheep in the wilderness, they haven't even got proper grazing land. In fact, everything about David is insignificant. Maybe Eliab is still smarting from being rejected in the previous chapter. He was overlooked. He was passed over for the youngest, the farm boy. And now the farm boy, who fancies himself an anointed king of Israel, comes to our army telling us how to do things. Go back to the sheep. Mind your own business. Clear off. He goes on. He says, "I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you've come down to see the battle." Before David can deal with Goliath, he has to deal with the opposition from Israel, from his own family, from his own brother. I'm afraid you find that. Eliab believes that David is proud, which in one respect is ironic, because I suspect it was Eliab's pride that possibly cost him the throne of Israel. But he sees David, and now he's been anointed by Samuel. He fancies himself a general, a warrior, a great strategist. "David, you're not fit to fight. Go back to entertaining an old man. Go back to looking after sheep. Go back to the wilderness, drumming your harp. Don't let people put you down. If your heart's right and your desire is to serve the Lord and his people, even if people impute to you false motives, don't let them." David said, "What have I done now?" Evidently, this kind of accusation from Eliab has already taken place. I imagine it's a regular theme. Now what? Is there not a cause? Is this not a fairly exceptional situation? They turned from him towards another and said the same thing, and he gets the same answer. I think the point to make here is that your support in this life comes from God, even if it doesn't come from God's people. "Now when the words which David spoke were heard, they reported them to Saul, and he sent for him." Evidently Saul has spies in the camp. He likes to know what his men are thinking. Or maybe Saul is so desperate that if anyone even hints or suggests he might be prepared to fight Goliath, Saul wants to hear from you. Sometimes it's like that in church, isn't it? You might say, you know, something needs to be done. The garden's looking a bit untidy. Brother, the Lord has called you to a gardening ministry. Go and do it. Well, perhaps. Nothing wrong with that. Or maybe Saul wanted some harp music. Then David said to Saul, "Let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with the Philistine." There we have a glimpse in the heart of David. The old expression, we have not windows into men's souls. No, we haven't. And yet from the fullness of the heart, the mouth does speak. And the kind of things we say indicate our spiritual state. And the fact that David doesn't mess about, he says, "I will go, I will do it, I will fight him. Come on." He has faith. Or is he being rash? Is he full of pride, like his brother asserts? I think more likely his trust in God is so great he can't see any danger or difficulty. Saul tries to put him off. He tells him that, well, for a start, David is just a youth, whereas Goliath is a man of war. His business is warfare. Your business is looking after sheep and playing a harp. His business, he's been trained to fight and to kill and various techniques of holding his weapons. He's done that since he was your age. It is simply not a fair match. Remember what Paul writes to Timothy on account of his youth. Don't let anyone look down on you because you are young. But set an example for the believers in speech, in life, in love, in faith, and in purity. There's an assumption here that youth itself is a disqualifying factor. Let me tell you, age is irrelevant. Now, this chapter is set in a period when young people were looked down upon. I put it to you that we are living in a period when older people are looked down upon. But the same principle applies. Let me tell you, friends, when we get to heaven, there will be no age. We will rub shoulders with John Wesley and Paul and Noah, and they won't look 2,000 years old. They'll look as fresh as they ever did, and so will you. Now, there'll be no birthdays in heaven as well. We won't be interested in how old we're getting because we won't be living in time. It's called eternity. And I say that we in the church should be reflecting the values of heaven. And if one of the values in heaven is that age neither qualifies nor disqualifies, then neither should it here. David replies by saying, "Your servant used to keep his father's sheep." Used to, as in yesterday. "And when a lion or bear came and took a lamb out of the flock, I went out after it and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it arose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it." Shepherds don't just play harps all day writing psalms. They protect their flocks. They defend their charges. Because there are lions and there are wolves that would very much like to eat those lambs, and the shepherd's job is to inform them otherwise and to rescue that lamb. And if the lion or the bear then turns upon the shepherd, you teach it a lesson it won't forget. He rescues the lamb and he defends himself from the aggressor. In other words, says David, I might be young, but I have already had combat. I too have been trained since my youth. Bears and lions. I may not have killed Goliath, but I'll add him to my list as well. Just let me go to him. He goes on to say, seeing as he has defied the armies of the living God. Could it be that when David was that shepherd, and I'm going to end on this point, and maybe as the youngest, he was despised doing farm work. Actually, it was while he was doing that despised farm work that God was training him for this particular day. And maybe you're thinking, what is God doing with me now? He doesn't seem to be doing anything. I'll tell you what he's doing. He's training you. He's preparing you. Because God has a work for every Christian here on earth until he calls you home. That's retirement, by the way. Sorry, Sue. It's not just getting your pension. It's being called home. That's retirement. A Sabbath rest for the people of God. Notice also what God can do with a pastoral heart. Eliab could fight, but he cared not for the lambs. Peter, feed my sheep. And what we do a little of now, God will give us more of later. Eliab and the other soldiers of Israel looked at Goliath and said, look, Goliath is unique. He's exceptional. He's different. We can't face him. Look how big he is. Look how wide he is. Look at that weaver shaft. Different. Whereas David looks at him and says, he's just another lion. He's just another bear. They fell. So will he. Because I go out with God. And no matter what that problem, what that difficulty, what that opposition, let me tell you, if God be with you, that lion, that bear, that Goliath, they'll all go the same way. Defy David the shepherd, and you'll die. Defy David the warrior, and you'll die. You see, he wasn't David who won the battle. Because the battle belonged to the Lord. But I'll finish it tonight. Amen.